From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. A spending deal is emerging in Congress to avoid a government shutdown on Friday night. It reportedly does not include any deportation protections for young immigrants who were brought here as children. Now, that's something Democrats wanted. The plan does include some money for barriers along the border with Mexico, but not for President Trump's wall.
And aides to the president are warning that it's a fireable offense for anyone inside the White House to leak the president's briefing papers. Now, you've probably heard reports today that just days after the U.S. sanctioned Russia for election interference, Trump made a call to newly reelected President Putin and congratulated him on his victory. Trump said so to the press. But apparently he did so, that congratulations, against advice, because the leaked briefing papers read, "Do not congratulate," in big capital letters. And then there's Cambridge Analytica, the firm founded by Trump backers Steve Bannon and Robert Mercer, that used 50 million Facebook users' data to influence voters in 2016. So let's bring in our political strategists in the midweek. This week we have John Brabender, the Republican strategist. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you doing?
And Bob Schrum, the Democratic strategist who now teaches at the University of Southern California. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And let me set up a question here for you on Cambridge Analytica, because it's not just the Facebook hoovering of private information that is upsetting some people. There's a Channel 4 investigation in Britain that shows Cambridge Analytica's Alexander Nix saying he can hire prostitutes and give bribes to sway elections. This is an undercover video. And then this.
Have you met with Mr. Trump?
Many times.
You have?
We did all the search, all the data, all the analytics, all the targeting, we ran all the digital campaign, the television campaign, and our data informed all the strategy.
So, John Brabender, let's start with you. The AP's already reported that former Trump advisor Michael Flynn, who pled guilty in the Russia investigation, was briefly a Cambridge Analytica advisor. Special counsel Robert Mueller is said to have asked Cambridge Analytica for emails. Congressman Trey Gowdy said that an email from Cambridge Analytica was part of the basis for the Russia investigation. What would you advise the White House to do about the fact that this company's in the spotlight and it worked for the Trump campaign?
Well, I think the difficulty here is understanding what did or did they not do for the campaign. And I have a little bit of firsthand knowledge about that. At the urging of Steve Bannon and Rebecca Mercer, I did meet with this firm on other campaigns I was working on. And I found them to be okay, but nothing unique. They did not talk about some of the Facebook data they had to me. I would certainly not have been interested. But I did not hire them for any of my campaigns because I didn't see any real advantage they have. I do know who was responsible for the digital and the data within the Trump campaign, and it was Brad Parscales. It certainly was not Alexander Nix. And so I think Bob would be the first to agree, because he's done a number of presidential races like I have myself. And it's amazing, when a presidential race does well, you find that there's a million consultants who all of a sudden that you didn't even see there take an incredible amount of credit for things they didn't do. And if you don't do well, it's like nobody ever worked on the race. And so I am very skeptical of any impact they really had on the Trump campaign. But I do find some of the things that we've learned, particularly the hidden camera, I find all that very troubling.
Do you think that this ends up hurting the White House, whether it should or not, John? I mean, it just, the connections are there. You know, it has a bad appearance in the anyways.
Well, look, I there's always something new that you can say, is this going to hurt the White House? This particular item, I think, is very, very inside baseball to the average person. I think that they see much bigger pictures out there, both positively and negatively, that they're concerned about. I think this is one of those stories that we will not be talking about 2 weeks from now.
You know, it's funny. I want to get to you, Bob. But, John, we're hearing elsewhere in the show that people in Britain are outraged because they're finding out that Cambridge Analytica was very active in the Brexit vote. But, Bob, would you be the first one to agree with John Brabender as he said that, you know, sometimes people claim credit and shouldn't get it?
Oh, sure, that's true. But what's also true here is Cambridge Analytica is in big trouble. The White House has a world of hurt right now, but it's not necessarily because of this. We won't know. I think the special counsel will go into this, the British Parliament will go into this, and we'll get some better idea of what role they actually played in the campaign. how connected it was, if at all, to the alleged Russian interference, and what impact they may have had. But John is certainly right with his overall point. If you win, everybody is the father of that victory, and if you lose, victory is an orphan.
Yeah, Bob, that's why I wonder if there is not a lesson here for Democrats, because we know that both parties have a serious interest in collecting voter data. This is how elections are being run now in this country, and certainly how they will be run far into the future. I mean, having the edge is the key. I mean, just this, the shoe could be on the Democrats' foot down the road.
Well, you got to be very careful about this, because everybody is always attracted to the latest bells and whistles, the new bright, shiny object. And the Clinton campaign really focused on data analytics to the extent, for example, that it did not poll in the battleground states in the last 2 weeks. That was a terrible mistake. And one thing that I think endures is that message matters. McLuhan was wrong. The medium is not the message. Donald Trump won the election, I think, because in those critical Rust Belt states, he won the message war. Yeah. He gave people an explanation for why they were in trouble. It was immigration. It was foreign trade. I don't happen to agree with what he said, but he gave them a simple explanation. And only 9% of Hillary Clinton's ads ever mentioned jobs or the economy. So in a way, the Clinton campaign invested very heavily in data analytics. The campaign manager was someone from data analytics, relied on it very heavily, and lost the message war to Donald Trump.
And when you say data analytics, you're not, this is a set, it's not the company Cambridge Analytics, which again, some people are more upset by the sordid things they said in the tapes. But I just want to point out one thing. I'll let you jump in there, John. But we spoke to the professor, David Carroll, on Monday, who's suing Cambridge Analytics. And he pointed out as well, he got the spreadsheet of the information that was taken from his Facebook page. He says it's not even true. It's not even accurate how they're sort of characterizing him and casting him. So, you know, beware there. John, I wanted to move on to to Russia, but did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I do. It's interesting because it's so rare these days in Washington that people of opposite sides agree, but I have to come in and agree 1,000% with Bob. And
you heard it right here on this show.
Yes.
Yeah. Collectively, I've also figured it out. We have over 60 years of consulting services together, but he got this absolutely right. What happens today, campaigns are always now looking for the secret sauce.
Cambridge Analytics said they had.
Said they had. And I see campaigns falling that over and over again, and the campaigns overspend on it and everything else, when it really does come down to message. And I would say Bob was 100% right. The Clinton people fell into the exact same trap, and what they never did is went to what I would call blue-collar conservative Democrats and gave them a message at the end of how Hillary Clinton was going to fight for them. Yep. What was she going to do for them? And I really do think that's why Donald Trump won more than anything.
John, I got to ask you, what was President Trump thinking against his advisors, congratulating Vladimir Putin on his pretty much fixed reelection?
Yeah, I agree with his advisors. I thought it certainly was a mistake. And I fall in the camp that say, look, I don't mind if we're going to have a good relationship with Russia, because there's no such thing as perfect allies anymore in the world that we live in. But oftentimes we have common enemies. And with Russia, we do. So we're always going to have an imperfect relationship with Russia. However, it does seem that on both sides of the aisle, we should first be speaking in a singular voice that we agree they interfered with our elections. We're going to take swift and strong actions to make sure it never happens again, and talk in a single voice and be critical of Russia for that. Then maybe we can move on. But to sort of not talk strong enough in that area, congratulate what obviously was a faux election, not a real election, I do find a little bit concerning.
Bob, your thoughts on this? Even President Obama supposedly congratulated Putin after an election, too. Is it a double standard here at all?
I don't think so, because we've come a long distance from Putin's last election. We had tensions with the Russians at that point. We didn't have the kinds of problems we have today, including, as John just referenced, the allegations about Russian interference in the 2016 election. The president is undisciplined. He basically does what he wants to do on the spur of the moment. I think his advisors were right. He shouldn't have done this. They could have had a very formal kind of call where he didn't have to say congratulations. He could have brought up the poisoning of the Russian, former Russian spy who turned into a British spy or an American spy who was living in Salisbury, England. He could have done those kinds of things. But it was stunning to see him do this. John McCain is right. The leader of the free world doesn't do it. And even more stunning was that someone in the White House staff leaked the whole story out.
Yeah, I got to get one question into John. The legal fight that President Trump is in with now three women. Law professor Jonathan Turley says the improprieties in the Stormy Daniels story, she was paid off $130,000 to be quiet. This is a bigger problem for Trump than the Russia investigation. Your thoughts? I got about a minute here.
Well, look, we went through the whole Billy Bush tape and everything else. Voters knew when they walked in there on Election Day everything they needed to know about Donald Trump.
I think he's talking about
voted.
The payoffs and the the lawsuits.
Look, I think these all fall under that same umbrella. And I one other thing, some of the women I think are very credible and have a right to stand forward. Stormy Daniels bothers me more than any of them for this reason, and I don't see this reported anywhere. In 2010, the Democrats put an ad out on Craigslist saying they're looking for an adult film star to run as a Republican for Senate to create havoc in the Republican Senate
campaign. Oh, you just dropped a stink bomb. We only have 15 seconds.
And you know who answered
that? By the way,
can
I make clear, I disagree. I disagree with John.
Stormy Daniels announced she would run as a Republican.
We're going to promise to research that. John Brabender, Bob Schrum, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
This is Here Now. All this week, we've been talking about bullying. Today, people of the Sikh religion are one of many religious minorities in the United States grappling with bias-based bullying. Half of all Sikh children say they are bullied in school, according to a report by the Sikh Coalition, and that is a rate roughly twice the national average. Asis Kaur is a community development manager for the Sikh Coalition. She spoke with Jeremy Hobson.
And you took up this cause after your younger brother was called a terrorist and beaten so badly that he required two surgeries. Tell us more about what happened with your brother, Japji Singh.
Sure. So the both of us grew up in Georgia. We attended the DeKalb County School District. What had happened was we had seen severe verbal bullying all throughout elementary school, and including a lot of things like being called a terrorist, being asked if you're a boy or a girl, a lot of 9/11 related jokes, things along the lines of, that's the day your dad died, and just a lot of other hurtful things all throughout elementary school. Things got more physical in middle school. And in 2012, to be more specific, he was assaulted at his middle school after lunch while walking from the lunchroom to his classroom before the class had started. And that's when he had taken several punches to his face, to his chest. He had broken his nose, dislocated other parts of his face, which required him to get two surgeries to recover from.
And this is all because of what he was wearing.
Yeah, this is all bias-based. This was all because of his perceived identity. This was because of what he looked like and that his turban and beard were something to be feared of.
After that terrible incident, did the bullying stop or did it continue?
It didn't stop. After that incident, he had his hair forcibly cut in the middle of class. Somebody had taken scissors and cut his hair from the back of his head. So when you tie a turban, there's some hair that kind of still shows in the back. And that's where the kids had cut the hair from, which to us felt like a harsher, more bolder attack than physically attacking him, because you can more easily recover from the bruising and the cuts and the stitches and the surgeries. But it's harder to pull yourself back up when you feel like someone physically tried to steal your identity from you.
What did your family tell you about the bullying that you two were experiencing?
So for years, my parents took the same actions that any concerned parent would take. We engaged with his teachers. We tried working with principals and other senior administrators. We were always trying to come up with creative ways to educate educators. we not just educators, but also educate parents and classmates about the Sikh community and what our role has been in America's history. We would always try to come up with some creative ways. I don't think there was a fall festival or a spring cleanup or any of those things that we missed, but it wasn't enough.
Why not?
Because even after, you know, he had been assaulted and then had his hair cut, kids went as far as threatening his life with a 9mm gun and a blade, and he was warned to not be surprised if he got stabbed. So we knew that we needed to do more to protect him. And to be honest with you, that's kind of where our story deviates from the norm, is after that assault, we kind of realized that whatever we've done isn't enough. And we started to realize there's far more kids out there who don't know who to turn to for additional support. So we knew that everything we had tried to make his schooling a better experience for him wasn't working. And that's when we contacted the Sikh Coalition, trying to seek legal support. And we weren't sure how exactly that would turn out to be. And because till now, most parents and families and kids have always dealt with these issues alone, because they're generally embarrassed or scared, or a lot of the immigrant parents might not know what resources exist, so they usually don't know who to turn to for help. So in our case, in Jupji's case, we proceeded to file an official complaint with the Department of Justice, which led to two landmark legal settlements that now protect more than 100,000 kids in the DeKalb County School District.
The Sikh Coalition found that Sikhs are more likely to be bullied if they wear turbans or other traditional clothing. Did you or your brother ever struggle with how to stay true to your religion while worrying that it'll make you a target?
Our community is very resilient. And for us, our hair and our articles of faith and our turban, it means that we stand up for what's just for everybody. It means that we pursue equality in every way possible. It means that we're tolerant and we're accepting and we're compassionate. And those are also active choices we have to make. So it was an active choice that my family and I made, that if these are the Sikh values, if we believe in justice, if we believe in equality, we couldn't ignore this issue. That we refuse to let bias-based bullying be ignored for, you know, in the country. This issue needed to be addressed.
Do you think it has been? Have things gotten better for Sikh children in this country?
So the report that you had mentioned, right, and you're correct in saying that more than two-thirds of the kids reported being bullied in school if they wore turbans. And have things gotten better? In the last year, I would say we have seen a lot more school bullying legal intakes. We have witnessed a dramatic rise in those. But that does not, that doesn't necessarily mean that bullying cases nationally on the rise. But it does mean that Sikh families know there are resources out there, that there is somebody who has their back, that there is somebody they can turn to for additional support. So more Sikh families are reporting these cases to us. Preventing bias-based bullying is at the core of our work. We address this internally within the community, but also externally outside the community. We have a multi-year state-by-state strategy of including Sikhism in state curriculum standards. We do workshops to educate the educators about who we are and our community's history. And internally, within the Sikh community, right, we're conducting workshops to educate Sikh parents and really reminding them that when their children are facing these issues in schools, it's a legal issue. These issues that we experienced, they altered my family's lives. And that's kind of when I knew that I didn't want it to dramatically alter somebody else's life. And you, Jeremy, and I having this conversation, we're making the problem matter, we're making it relevant, and we're making it real. that itself is a step in the right direction. And as long as we remain engaged with our community, our elected officials, and all of the other stakeholders like school superintendents and any other senior administrators, you know, we'll keep making sure that our kids are protected, they're having a great childhood, they're learning, and they're blossoming in schools.
Do you think there's a lesson for people who are not sick, who may be bullied for other reasons?
The greatest lesson is finding that courage within yourself to speak out. If, you know, my brother or the thousands of other Jepchis out there who are trying to find that courage within themselves, my only message to them and the greatest, you know, takeaway is to find that courage to speak out. Because until we speak out, we can't acknowledge the problem. And if we can't acknowledge the problem, if we can't make it real, if we can't make it relevant, we can't address it. And we're on the right paths of addressing these issues. And we're not going to, and, you know, we refuse to let our country ignore these problems.
Has your brother been in contact at all with the person who assaulted him after the fact?
No, he hasn't.
Has he gotten an apology or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of, but I would say that mediations are a great way to address these issues, to foster learning, to foster better communication, and to foster compassion, which I think is key in changing our perspectives.
That's Asis Kaur, who is a community development manager for the SICK Coalition. Asis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The Trump administration is ratcheting up plans to change the U.S. trading relationship with China. The White House is expected to release an outline for new trade measures against China tomorrow. It could include tariffs worth more than $30 billion, according to the Wall Street Journal. The administration is also looking at what it says are unfair intellectual property practices. And perhaps no surprise here, China appears ready to retaliate. Let's bring in Robin Farzad. He's host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. And Robin, President Trump recently announced broad tariffs on steel and aluminum. Those start as soon as Friday. But, you know, these are different. So what's the White House thinking about in terms of additional tariffs on China?
Yeah, China is the rhetorical pinata if you're on the campaign trail. Like, I'm going to get tough on China. You know, Obama and Bush and Clinton weren't. And you think about China, it turns out so much. If you're Trump, you're asking yourself, where can you hit them to best provoke them? And to that end, we're hearing that the tariffs are going to be directed at Chinese IT, telecom, and consumer products. And you mentioned intellectual property. China is just so adept at counterfeiting high-value goods. Textiles, furniture, luxury wares, it's often so difficult to tell real versus knockoff. And it puts you in a terrible bind if you're a U.S. company wanting to avail yourself of China's competitive you know, advantages in manufacturing. Yeah, I get my product done with scale affordably, but the factory's already leaked the instructions to a counterfeiter down the road.
Well, exactly. What else can you tell us about the way that China supposedly is stealing intellectual property from the United States?
You know, this has always been a complaint with software products, you know, DVDs. You go to these hawker stalls across South Asia and Southeast Asia, and this has been a problem with the recording industry and the film industry for the longest time. Like, how are they doing this? But it's also a big problem with luxury manufacturers. I mean, if you need China to churn out a you know, something at a comparative discount quickly to ship it to the West Coast, you're handing over the instructions and in detail format. And it's a race against people who are going to ape that cheaply coming out in 2 weeks.
Now, when the president said he was going to be putting tariffs, broad tariffs across the globe on steel and aluminum, all these countries, our allies around the world, were raising their hand and say, why are you picking on us? Pick on China. That's what you should be focusing on. And now it seems that the president is, in fact, directing these next measures directly against China. So, you know, what are U.S. businesses and industry thinking about this round of tariffs?
You know, Peter, we've already seen about four dozen U.S. trade groups, and they represent enormous multinationals and small firms and agricultural concerns alike. They're urging Trump to be more measured. The White House, you know, in justifying playing hardball with China, says that, look, good faith, it didn't do Obama, Bush and Clinton, you know, great shakes against China. China's been a net abuser of trade imbalances over, say, 15 or 16 years. We get cheap goods dumped on our shores. Our factories close while their economies grow. So it's time to get tough. So hold my beer, you know?
Yeah, real quick. Are we expected to see interest rates raised today?
Yeah, I mean, on a continued path coming out of the Great Recession, the irony here, the difficulty is that we are still below where interest rates were, where you know, when the huge pyrotechnics of Lehman Brothers in the fall of 2008 happened. The economy has since normalized. Property is back. The stock market's back. But interest rates are nowhere near normal.
All right. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thank you very much.
Be well, Peter.
Author John Edgar Wideman has been a Rhodes Scholar, a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, a two-time Penn Faulkner Award winner, and a National Book Award finalist. So at 76, you'd think he would rest on those laurels, but he says he's feeling freed by his age. In his new short story collection, he takes on nothing less than American Histories, which is also the title. There is history here that belongs to all of us. We find ourselves aboard the slave ship, the Amistad, then with Nat Turner. And history that we wonder, is this his alone? He's had several painful family passages. He's a writing professor, and oh, look, there's a character who's a writing professor. And John Edgar Wideman joins us from the NPR studios in New York. John, welcome.
Thank you.
We want to jump in right there. You write about the Williamsburg Bridge and a character who frequently walks it, but in your story is considering jumping off it. And then we remember that New York Times Magazine feature on you in which you walk the bridge with a reporter and apparently walk it a lot. There's another story. The narrator talks about his mom who refused to give birth to him because it was Friday the 13th. The narrator was born on the 14th. So were you.
It's kind of mysterious, isn't it? There are a lot of coincidences, probably too many to be accidental. And I guess one subject of the book is, what is this stuff that you're reading, reader? I don't know exactly what it is, and I want you to kind of play with me or read along with me, and maybe puzzling out some of these issues will help us understand the stories.
Talk about the first story, JB and FD, which I really liked because it signaled sort of an intimacy. JB being the abolitionist John Brown, white, caught and hanged after a raid on Harper's Ferry in Virginia. FD, Frederick Douglass, the escaped slave. He used oratory. And you have these imagined, well, I think they're imagined conversations between the two. Did you lean on letters between the two? Did John Brown actually implore Frederick Douglass to come to Harper's Ferry?
I heard a question before the other question. Why are these dudes FD and JB? Well, that's raising the issue of history and raising the issue of the authority of a narrator and the authority of any story. I call people by their initials when they're good buddies, and that's a kind of street thing too. Here comes JF or here comes KC. It's fun. It's intimate. And so by presuming to call these gentlemen, these historical figures, by initials already sets up a kind of relationship between the narrative voice and the characters. I just wanted to raise the curtain in a way that said, hey, these people are distinguished. These people lived in another time, but maybe they're also a little bit like you. Let's get right up front and personal.
It absolutely made me think of them in a different way. But I also found myself Googling a lot. Frederick Douglass's second wife was white. What were you trying to find out as you tried to become more intimate with them, make them guys you might play basketball with at one time, right? What were you trying to find out?
I think I was just throwing out lines. A fisherman might throw out lines or nets and willing to take whatever I could get. And I wasn't sure whether or not I had a subject for a story. But I did know, and this speaks to your point about information and Googling, one which I have not quite resolved and realized it had not been resolved when copy editors and fact checkers were going over the script. That is, as far as possible, the historical information is accurate. Mm. The two men did know one another. They did meet often. They had a kind of a quasi-secret relationship towards the end of their lives because John Brown was essentially a fugitive. And there was a price on his head. And just before he went to Virginia to actually commence that raid on Harper's Ferry, he did talk with Frederick Douglass. Hmm. I relied on that for part of the story. I do a lot of work.
Right. Well, so for instance, Horatio Seymour, governor of New York, really did, in addressing a mob in 1863 of hungover, mostly Irish immigrants, their hands still red from 3 or 4 days of wasting colored children, women, and men in draft riots. He really did say, "My friends," in calling out to them.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
How much of it is, as a black man, trying to figure out how the heck did people cope?
Well, my books are not about how it feels to be a black man. My books are about how it feels to be a human being. And part of what I'm trying to sort out is what we mean, what I mean, what you mean, what everybody in the culture means. When they say black man or they say white person, and this racial identification remains a kind of weird sort of mythology and superstition that still haunts us and still divides us. And so I'm always writing at some level to sort of loosen that grip of race on our collective imagination, which is not to say race does not exist in one sense, but certainly to call into question the notion that any human being is somehow defined by some quality that's kind of hammered in or hand of God in before birth. Mm.
To the maybe most painful observations of the biographical, the characters have fathers who have killed someone, brothers who are in jail, sons, nephews who have been imprisoned, while the narrator tries to be a writing professor, tries to have their life. You have a brother who was imprisoned, a son who, while this was years ago in 86, he was on tour with some teenagers, stabbed his sleeping roommate in the chest. The boy died. And though your son was only 16, he was tried as an adult, convicted, sent to prison. He's since been released. These are, you know, very painful personal stories. How much were you trying to work through those here?
My son was released, but then he was reincarcerated, and that's a whole story in itself. There's no way you would know that. But the title of my book is American Histories, plural. And as far as I'm concerned, my reading of history is it is a sort of nightmare. It is a sort of nightmare. I'm trying to wake up from it. And as any nightmare, it's full of much that is unspeakable. And unfortunately, from my purview, most people's lives contain incidents, stuff that happens to them, stuff that happens to people they love, stuff that happens in the culture in which they reside, events that are unspeakable, just too painful to bear. And so you're left as an individual, as a human being, with this unfinished business. And there's a lot of it. And my response to those things in my life is to interrogate them, try to make sense of them, sing about them, cry about them, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's my answer. I'm coping, coping with history, coping with what it means to be alive. How do you talk about the Holocaust? How do you talk about slavery? probably the best thing to do would just be quiet, hide from it, forget about it, except then it jumps up and bites you because it's there.
Well, and families have Holocausts. I'm very, very sorry to hear your son was reincarcerated. But John Edgar Wideman, when you say, you know, the list of things you do about the things that are too unbearable to talk about, when you say sing, do you mean write?
Well, I think they have a connection for me anyway. That's my that's who I am now. I could say that I dealt with those things when I played basketball. I loved basketball. There was nothing like going out on a Saturday afternoon or in the evening after school and getting on the basketball court and just giving it all up and wanting to fly. And that was a kind of singing.
John Edgar Wideman's new collection of short stories is American Histories. Thank you so much for talking to us about them.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Community colleges and some four-year universities are trying to help students who need help with the fundamentals. Right now, just 15% of students enrolled in a remedial course go on to get an associate's degree in 5 years, and only 5% get a bachelor's degree. In Massachusetts, schools are looking for new ways to get students caught up in math. Carrie Young of member station WBUR reports.
For college sophomore Christine Seafray, one statistics class is all that stands between her and an associate's degree in liberal arts.
I did all the classes that I needed to do to graduate and then procrastinated and did my math last.
Seafray hates math.
Math is scary for me.
When she started classes here at Northern Essex Community College just north of Boston, she took the state math placement test but didn't score high enough to go directly into the statistics course she needed to graduate. Instead, she had to take a remedial class like this one to get up to speed.
So if I create this probability statement...
This is Statistics Fusion, and today Professor Rachel King is going over the basics of probability. Remedial students like Seafray go to this class just before heading into the regular college statistics course later in the day. It's known officially as a co-requisite course, but it's essentially 2 hours of extra help.
So we sampled a total of 449 students.
The school says the main benefit of Math Fusion courses is they save students time, because in the past, getting through remedial math could take up to 3 additional semesters.
We lose most of our students on developmental math.
Habib Magul is the math department chair at the community college. He says the idea of taking 3 semesters of math overwhelmed a lot of students, and many dropped out.
Oh my God, I'm taking 3 classes. I don't go toward my degrees. And he felt like you don't have this too much.
But this isn't just a Northern Essex issue. According to the latest statewide data from 2012, only 21% of students who got placed in a developmental class in Massachusetts went on to pass a college-level course. Carlos Santiago is the Massachusetts Commissioner of Higher Education. He says while it's easy to blame K-12 schools, especially those that are underperforming and happen to serve mostly low-income and minority students...
We had to take some responsibility for this. So we said, okay, let the campuses experiment.
And experiment they did.
See what happens if you get rid of the remedial classes.
Some schools are letting students with a 2.7 GPA bypass remedial classes altogether, even if they don't pass the state placement test. Others, like Northern Essex, are trying the co-requisite model. And some are tailoring math classes to students' majors, so elementary education students don't have to slug through calculus.
And there were a lot of skeptics. They were saying, oh no, these students aren't going to succeed.
While the Higher Education Department is still processing statewide data on what has been a 4-year pilot project, initial results are showing some promise. Officials at Framingham State University say co-requisite students are doing just as well as their peers in college-level math. At Roxbury Community College in Boston, the math passage rate among remedial students more than doubled. And while Santiago maintains these models aren't for every student,
the fact that we have fewer students needing to remediate, I'll take that as a win.
But Santiago says reducing the number of students who have to remediate is more than just a math problem for him. He hopes the effort gets more students, particularly students of color, to graduation and better-paying jobs, rather than just strapped with more debt. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Young.
And we wanted to check in now with an Austinite, now that the string of deadly bombings there appears to have ended. Sandy Coco lives in Harris Ridge, the neighborhood where the first bomb exploded on March 2nd. Sandy, you must be relieved now that police say the suspect is dead, although he may have left packages.
Well, that's what the authorities are saying, to still be on the lookout. They don't know where he's exactly been for the last 24 hours. Yeah. And then just looking at the pictures of this kid, I mean, I'm just like, you know, good gracious. The news that it may be over, it couldn't have come any faster. It's been quite surreal.
Yeah. I mean, what were you finding yourself not going out? I hear somebody in your neighborhood was killed. How were you living?
Most Austinites were still living day to day. We were just hyper aware. I can tell you that every night and every morning I checked my front porch. Mm. When I did go out, I was always paying attention to the surroundings and almost looking at people wondering, you know, are you the one responsible? So it's been very surreal is kind of the word I keep coming back to.
Yeah. Sandy, actually, you called me during our coverage. I misspoke. I said that your neighborhood was a black neighborhood. I meant to say it was a black victim in your neighborhood. It sounded like you really wanted to get out a message to people, not just correct me, which I'm glad you did, but get out a message to people about Austin. What do you want people to know?
Austin's a great, diverse city, and I'm pretty proud of the neighborhood I live in because we have many different cultures in this neighborhood. It's a welcoming place that you, most of the time, you feel safe and accepted for who you are.
That's Sandy Coco of Austin, Texas, regrouping after the last several weeks. Sandy, thanks so much, and I'm so glad it appears to be over.
Thank you, Robin.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.